Welcome back to the FKT Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today I'm joined by Cam Bostock, who set the unsupported northbound Bibbulmun Track FKT in 14 days, 7 hours, and 49 minutes. Cam, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I'm excited to chat with you.
Yeah, excited to be here.
So the first thing I'd like to do, I would imagine a decent number of our listeners are familiar with the Bibbulmun Track, but could you just describe what that trail is, where it's at, kind of paint a picture of this route that we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm from Perth, Western Australia, and the Bibbulmun Track is sort of my home through hike. Very lucky to have a long trail here in Western Australia. It's a very flat state, and so there's not a lot of hiking or multi-day hiking, but we do have this one trail that's 1,000 kilometers long, 650 miles, give or take. And it runs from the capital of Western Australia, which is my state, and it runs down to the south coast of the state into a town called Albany. And yeah, it's a spectacular trail, super beautiful and diverse. There's little mountains, nothing too big. And then there's just, you know, beautiful old growth forest and incredible beach walking and coastline towards the south half of the trail. So it's really, really a stunning trail, and it's becoming more and more popular, which is really cool to sort of see. I think through hiking in general is just sort of increasing in popularity year by year, and that's sort of overflowing onto the Bibbulmun Track. And I've walked it twice now, the second time for the FKT, and there was just like, I talked to people from, I think I counted 18 different countries on the trail while I was out there, and that was just super cool to see. So yeah, we're very lucky to have it. And it's a pristine trail. You know, the Bibbulmun Track Foundation do an incredible job, all the volunteers, of maintaining it. So mostly single track, mostly completely clear. And there are 49 campsites along the track. So roughly every 20 kilometers or so. And the campsites have like an open air shelter, a long drop toilet, a water tank or two. And so it's a really accessible hike for people as well to kind of get out on the first multi-day section or their first through hike, because it's kind of forgiving. Like, you're always going to have a roof over your head at night and water and a toilet, and there's a bunch of trail towns as well that you walk directly through. So yeah, great trail.
It's funny that you mentioned how many people from different countries and stuff you've seen out there, because I only really know of one long distance hike in Australia, and it's the Bibbulmun Track, and it's because I have two or three friends who've also through hiked it. So it is just kind of funny, like, for whatever reason, maybe it is the best and most premier route in Australia, but it is the one that I feel like everybody knows, at least here in the US.
Yeah, it's definitely probably the most iconic long trail. On the East Coast, we have like the Great Dividing Range, the Australian Alps, and there's a incredible long trail that follows the Alps as well. And, you know, you've got snow and sort of alpine region, which is awesome as well, but probably not as walked as the Bibbulmun. And then we have a lot of really incredible, iconic sort of like 2 to 7 day treks, but nothing super long like you would in the US.
Right.
So the Bibb Track is definitely the most well known, and it's cool that you've even heard of it, actually. That's awesome.
Yeah, I actually have a fairly good friend who just hiked it this last year. So I guess it was probably about the time you were out there, actually. And he's a botanist, so he was posting all kinds of cool plants and animals along the way. It was really fun to follow along on that. So
that's another cool part about the Bibb Track, especially in spring when the wildflowers bloom and the orchids are out, is there is so many endemic flora species in the southwest of Australia. And if you're into that, which it sounds like your mate is, you can have a field day. There's just, you know, so many flowers and trees and, you know, different, you know, I'm not super into all that, so I couldn't tell you what they're all called, but I do know that it's sort of like a big deal for a lot of people as well.
You said you've done this now end to end twice. Why did you choose to, or well, I should preface this by saying this is the first FKT on our website. I don't know, maybe you've done other FKTs that aren't on our site, but why did you choose to do this as the first FKT on our site? And also, why did you go unsupported? Because arguably, that's the hardest modality. And like you just said, there's plenty of cities and places along the way to resupply. So maybe just talk a little bit about the mindset of why you chose that option.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I'm a through hiker, and I've always been interested in FKTs, and sort of the more I've followed from afar and, you know, watched people like yourself go out and do these epic things, I've realized that I think the unsupported category is where I can actually shine. Like, I'm not much of a runner, and I don't think I would excel in a supported attempt where most of it's running. And just like, a month before I set the unsupported FKT, the supported FKT was broken, and it's a ridiculous time of like around 9 days. And, you know, it's like 110 plus kilometers a day. And I was just like, there's no way I can do that. I'm just not a runner, but I have through like the PCT and Teatro, and I'm good at that. And I'm good at carrying weight on my back. I'm a pretty heavy set guy. So like, it just makes sense to me to go for the unsupported. And yeah, I'd spent a couple months in Europe prior to doing this FKT, doing a lot of hiking in the Alps and intentionally carrying a really heavy pack to just sort of see how I'd go. And yeah, the body just responded really well to it. I felt super strong. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go for this unsupported FKT. A friend of mine who also lives here in Perth in 2024 had set the unsupported time. And yeah, he definitely inspired me to give it a crack as well. And of course, I just wanted to beat his time. You know, he's a mate. We both walked the PCT in 2024 and he did it off the back of that. So, you know, all of those kind of factors came into it. And I always knew if I was going to do an FKT, it would be on the bib track because that's just like the first long trail I ever walked. It's in my backyard. Logistically, it was going to be a breeze. And I knew it like the back of my hand. I've walked so many sections so many times. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I think like the last 3 years, I'd be like, this spring, I'm going to do an FKT. Originally, I was looking to do the self-supported, but then as time went on, I'm like, this unsupported makes more sense for me. And 2025 was just finally the year that I gave it a crack.
I tell people, I'm like, cater to your strengths. You know, you may not be the fastest person out there, but you know, if you can carry a lot of weight and go for a long time, you can still set FKTs. That's why we have different categories. They're very different experiences.
Yeah, that's, I'm definitely playing to my strengths with the unsupported category, I think. And so, yeah, I had such a good time. Like I'm interested in pursuing other trails and other FKTs at some point as well. But this was the first, and yeah, it was an interesting experience.
Yeah. And I look forward to hearing a little bit more about that. The big question I always have, you know, having done unsupported long FKTs myself, what was your pack weight? You can give it in kilograms if you want.
Yeah. So I'm going to have to translate to pounds, I think, but I'll try and do both. So I started without water, 17 kilograms, which will be 35 pounds, I guess, ish.
Okay.
And yeah, 90% of that was food, obviously. So because of the campsites that are spaced, you know, roughly 20 kilometers apart along the trail, you really need to carry more than a liter of water. And so, you know, maybe at the start I had 500 mils of water, I reckon. So maybe 17 and a half kilograms was my peak weight right at the beginning. Yeah, which felt really heavy to me. But in the grand scheme of things, I know that you had a lot more on the AZT. And, you know, it's funny because I met people on the bib track walking last season while I was out there who had heavier base weights than I did with all my food and gear. So it's like, it's kind of all relative, but
yeah,
felt heavy.
Definitely all relative, especially compared to what you're used to carrying. The water makes a huge difference. I mean, yeah, I was carrying a lot more weight on the AZT, but a lot of that was water.
Yeah.
Water's so heavy. So
I think the longest water carry on the bib track is about 20 miles. And so, you know, I think I carried 2 liters for that section or 2.5 liters because it wasn't super hot that day. But other than that, I was just trying to carry as little as possible at all times. And that ended up being somewhere between 500 mils and a liter between tanks.
Can you talk a little bit about what the food was that you ate? Obviously, 90% of your pack was food. So what were you eating? What was the food? What was your nutrition strategy?
Yeah, I obviously tried to just go for the highest calorie to weight dense foods possible, but I had no experience trying to optimize for weight versus calories before this. So, you know, I did a bunch of research and talked to some mates of mine who have done FKTs and just try to figure out the best way to go. Ends up being a lot of sort of high fat foods, as you know. So I had dehydrated meals I had for my dinners that I would cold soak. So just like pre-made ones, I guess, because that was just easiest for me. And the calorie to weight ratios are already pretty optimized and the dehydrated, obviously. And then throughout the day, I would have a lot of chocolate. That was probably the main source of calories for me. I had like 20 massive blocks of Cadbury chocolate, which is like our go-to brand here in the pack. Mm-hmm. And I just like kind of buried them in the middle of the pack so they wouldn't melt and they all survived, which is good. That was a big part of it. I had a lot of like dehydrated cheese as well, which I really enjoyed eating, like cheddar cheese. That was really nice. And then I actually brought like a meal for breakfast as well. So I had like some sort of cereal a few different types with full cream milk powder. And that was always actually the best part of my day, was having that meal and drinking like my like chocolatey milk, if it was like my chocolatey cereal or whatever after it. And I'd have that sort of a couple hours into the day each morning. And then like various other snacks. Like I had a bit of beef jerky because it was just nice to chew on, and you could chew on it for a while, and it was, you know, some nice protein. I had a bit of candy, Oreos, like just, you know, a few like nice to have snacks. And I tried to bring like a bunch of variety because I knew that I would get sick of having the same thing over and over again. So even with my chocolate, like I had 20 bars, but they were all different flavors, and just tried to keep it fresh. And I was pretty happy with the food that I brought, actually. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I was always hungry 24/7, but I enjoyed the food that I had, which is good.
That's good. So what happened to me on the Arizona Trail, because I also tried to optimize for calories to weight. So I had a lot of chocolate, a lot of nuts, a lot of high fat food. And I was just so hungry for carbs. Like I clearly didn't bring enough sugar, mm-hmm. things that are fast. Did you have that, or did you end up having enough easy burn carbs with you?
Yeah, I had like a little tiny bit of candy. It was just kind of like a bit of a pick-me-up, but I think I finished that in like 4 days or something. Mm-hmm. So I had none for the rest of it. And then I had my Oreos and stuff. But yeah, I was craving sugar the whole time, even though I had a fair bit with me. And I was always just hungry. Like I always felt like I had enough energy to get the miles in, but there was never a time where my stomach wasn't rumbling and I was starving. So I think overall I'm happy with what I brought. I think if I was to change anything, it would be a bit more candy probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I realized quickly I needed to ration my candy to make it last the whole time, because I was like, this is all I want to eat, you know, and it's like, all right, you get to have this when you're going up a prolonged climb and that's it.
Yeah, I tried to ration, but it just didn't last. I had the nerd clusters, which are just like the go-to through hiking food, and they just, I couldn't resist, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to resist when you want the thing that's in your pack.
And then when you run out of candy and then you walk past a buddy supermarket the next day and you're like, oh, the shelf's full of it in there and you can't touch it. That was a difficult thing to do.
Yeah. And I feel like I've tried to describe this to people, and it's kind of hard if you haven't been in this situation yourself, but can you talk a little bit about that mental side of walking past support that you can't accept and how that felt and how that played out for you on the hike?
Yeah, I knew that would be a big challenge, because all the Bibberman track towns you walk through, well, you can hitch out to some if you want extras, but like all you really need for resupply, you basically walk through the towns. And so literally walking down the main street of like 7 different towns throughout the trek, which is like one every 2 days on average, because I was out there for 14 days. And I don't know, it's for some reason I was always walking through in the morning, I guess because I would always camp sort of like the previous hut that was just outside of a town, because I couldn't obviously camp in the town. Mm-hmm. So I'd walk through in the morning and all the cafes would be opening and I could smell the coffee and I could smell the bakeries firing up. And I would always take a little video clip of like zooming in onto the stores as I walked past, because it was just like this, it just like felt like I was like almost being pulled in. Yeah, it was tough for sure. And there were quite a few times where other hikers offered me help as well. Like there was one time where it was just an extremely wet day and I was freezing cold and I finally made it to camp and I was just miserable. And, you know, my sleep gear was not warm and I didn't have a great setup just to save on weight. And people were offering me like their extra jumpers and they were offering me to make me a hot drink because I didn't have a stove and like all this stuff. And I just had to sort of be like, no, I can't take any help. And that was always, it was always very hard to say no, that's for sure. But, you know, you kind of gotta, it's interesting in an unsupported attempt, because like, it's not really any accountability. Like I could just take a hot coffee from someone and like, I don't know, who's going to know,
right.
But I was just so determined to do it and do it the right way that I had to really practice the self-control for sure.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, it is one thing, luckily, like for most of the unsupported things I've done, you don't walk through quite as many towns as you do, at least not right through them. But it's really, because you can kind of steel yourself for that, like, okay, I'm going to walk through this town, just got to ignore it. But, you know, it is really hard to turn down people on the trail, you know, that interpersonal, and you're trying
to explain to them why you're not accepting it, because it, logically you just accept you're like miserable.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And they're just like, I don't understand. For me, the hardest thing was when I fell and I hurt myself when I was on the Arizona Trail and some hikers came along while I was in the trail bleeding and trying to convince them not to help me and to leave me alone. Yeah. And I was fine. And they were just like, they didn't want to leave. They thought I was crazy or, you know, something. And I'm like, no, trust me. I just can't take anything from you.
Yeah, it's wild. It's a very unique challenge for sure. And I was sort of like trying to post stuff online as I was doing it because I'm a full-time content creator. I just wanted to keep people in the loop. And so a lot of people on trail actually did know what I was doing, which is cool. And so there was like this level of like, I'd meet some people and they'd see me and they'd be like, oh, like, do you need anything? Oh, wait, like, we can't help you kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it was a bit of a mixed bag, but one of the bigger challenges.
Aside from food, which was most of your pack, what else were you carrying? Obviously, you mentioned not being quite warm enough out there, but what was your gear?
Yeah, so because of the shelters along the bib, I didn't bring a tent because I knew I could just, well, you have to camp at these campsites, the official campsites. There's no wild camping pretty much allowed at all besides a couple of small exceptions. And so no matter what, I was going to be under a roof at night, so no tent, which is a big weight saving, or no tarp or any type of shelter. And so I just had a foam mat, and I cut it down to half length, so it was just, you know, my butt and my back on it. And I brought a little pillow along as well, so I could cut another panel off the foam mat and just use the pillow for my head. Unfortunately, the pillow got a hole in it on the first night, so
oh no,
ended up becoming mostly useless. And then I had a very lightweight sleeping bag that had a false bottom on it. So it was just, you know, no zip. It was just like very minimalist. And most nights I was fine. I think it was a 3 degree sleeping bag, Celsius. I have no idea what that is in Fahrenheit, but just above freezing. And most nights I was completely fine in that, but there was just a couple of nights where it was really wet and I came in really cold, that I was like shivering for quite some time before I got warm. And yeah, I had like a Durst & Kakwa backpack, which was so good, handled the weight brilliantly. I was a big fan of that. And yeah, just my cold soaking jar and my satellite communicator. Didn't really have much else.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting when I'd empty my pack, like I'd take out my gear bag and my sleep setup, and it was like this tiny little Nyla Flynn bag. And then this 50-liter pack is still mostly full and it's just freaking food all the way to the bottom. It was very nice towards the end when there was no food left. I had literally nothing on my back. Felt like a feather.
I had that experience on the AZT. Like, I didn't even unpack my bag at night. I just ate whatever the food was that was on top, because I was like, I'm not pulling all this food out of here, because it would take me 10 minutes to unpack this. It's just staying put.
Because you had like
too much
over
to deal with.
20 days of food, right?
Yeah, I had 3 weeks of food. Yeah.
Yeah, that's like a whole other week of extra food than what I had. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I had a tent and everything too, so yeah. Mm-hmm. What about water treatment? You mentioned the water containers at the campsites. So do you have to treat that water, or is it potable?
I treated it all with just like a chemical with the tablets.
Okay.
Most of it's potable though. Like you'd probably get away with it. Like when I through hiked it with not outside the FKT, I barely treated the water at all, but I just wanted to play it safe for the FKT and not have to stop just because I drank bad water. Because there have been reports of like the tanks getting like a rat that died in them or something, and then people get sick. So I treated everything, just nothing physical, no physical filters, just with the tablets. And I did that with every single drop that I drank. I was pretty diligent about it. I just wanted to play it safe with water, basically. But like I didn't take from pretty much any natural sources. Like there's plenty of rivers and streams and stuff, but just the prevalence of the water tanks at huts is so convenient. You know, like it's a different world to a trail like the AZT or some of the other long trails in Australia where, you know, it's really hard to find water and you have to go searching and you have to do big carries. The bib is just, you just know you're guaranteed water within a couple of hours at all times. And it's really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, having that guaranteed location for sleeping in water is really great. You know, you're not having to search for those things.
The downside of that though is like, because you're forced to sleep at these awesome shelters, you are limited to how far you can go each day. You can't, the shelters are 20K apart. So you know, you have to go 40, 60 or 80K in a day. You can't go 50 or 70 or 45. Like you have to stop at a shelter or push to the next one. So that was like sort of one of the downsides of the camping sort of system on the bib track. And there was many days, especially at the start, where I'm like, I've got 10K left in me, but the next campsite's 20K and I don't think I quite have that in me, or it's like not smart to push that hard today. And there are a few days where I decided to push extra for the day and it's like, you know, it's 20 kilometers extra and maybe I only should have done 10. And so it was an interesting sort of juggling out trying to manage that. I had this itinerary that I planned and then I ditched that on like the third day and just kind of winged it. So it was an interest, like there's pros and cons to having those campsites for an FKT like this, at least.
Did you end up hiking in the dark, or because of the way this was set up, did you end up just, you know, pretty much hiking in the daylight hours?
The first week it was mostly in the daylight hours. I wanted to stick to about 35 miles a day for the first week while my pack was heaviest. And also it's kind of the hardest section that first week because you're doing a lot of beach walking and walking on dunes. And so it's quite taxing with the weight on your back. And so, yeah, I was able to do most of my walking in the daytime, which was really nice. But very quickly after sort of the first maybe 6 days, I started walking into the night most nights and getting up while it was dark most mornings. And yeah, luckily there's no big predators and things to worry about, like mountain lions or wolves or bears. And so no issues at all walking at night. I actually really enjoyed it. I was listening to your podcast. I can't remember what podcast it was, but you were on it talking about the AZT and you were talking about how when you start before the sun comes up, it almost is like none of those hours or miles count once the sun comes up. It's like the day starts and whatever you've done, you know, it doesn't even, like, it doesn't feel like it even
happened.
Doesn't exist. And that is so true. I love that feeling. There was one time where I started at midnight, walked for 6 hours and the sun came up and I was pretty run down through those 6 hours, you know, not much sleep. But then the sun came up and it just like felt like the day had restarted. And I just felt new. It was the coolest thing ever. And it's interesting. Just daylight has so much power. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned no big predators, but I guess the thing I think of very much when I think of Australia and the Bibbulmun is snakes. So are those not a concern in the dark, or maybe because you're from Australia, you're just not concerned about snakes like Americans are?
Yeah, snakes are not a concern at night for the most part. Okay. They'll be hidden away. The snakes will come out and because they're cold-blooded, they want to spend time in the sun. And so in the daytime, they'll go to a place like the trail because it's open. And so they'll be quite prevalent.
Okay.
And so I saw a lot of very dangerous and deadly snakes, especially in the south portion of the Bibb track, but all in the daytime. At night, it's not really something that I think about.
Okay.
Yeah, it's always interesting telling to Americans about dangerous wildlife because you guys have it so much worse than we do, because you have snakes, you know, like you have rattlesnakes, like they're terrifying, and then all these big things. But yeah, like there's plenty of snakes on the Bibb track and spiders and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, no issues walking at night. And I just had to be really sort of switched on in the daytime because if you step on one, it's going to end the through hike basically if it bites you. So whether it's an mates you or not. And so there were quite a few times where, you know, I had to step around a big tiger snake on the trail or whatever. I think I saw maybe 15 snakes or something throughout the trek. So, you know, quite a few. Yeah. And it is a little nerve-wracking when you see one, but you just give them a wide berth and they don't typically want to bother you.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of goes for most animals. They don't really want to bother you. Yeah. I've seen so many snakes in the U.S. at night. So that's why I asked. I've seen copperheads, rattlesnakes, like, I don't know, maybe American snakes just prefer to come out at night. I don't know. I guess in the desert, it's too hot during the day for them. So they actually come out kind of when it cools off at night. So
I don't think I've ever seen a snake at night here. I mean, I haven't done that much night hiking, but yeah, they're very active in the day.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned spiders too. Is there any other wildlife? I know my friend posted a lot of kangaroo photos. Did you see other animals along the way?
Yeah, lots of kangaroos and emus and like smaller marsupial species that are native to Western Australia, which is really cool. Yeah, it was always nice seeing animals. Like I see quite a lot of kangaroos at night actually because they're very active around dawn and dusk. And so when the sun sets, they're typically out and about. There are a couple of times where I like there'd be this huge kangaroo taller than me, like on the trail at night. And I'd just like, you know, they're not going to attack you.
Okay.
Usually, but they're huge and like they don't move a lot of the time. So there were a few run-ins like that. And then just so many like beautiful birds and flowers. Like there was a lot to look at on the Bibb, which is a lot of fun. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so what is kangaroo protocol? If you run into a kangaroo and it doesn't want to get out of your way, do you just like wait?
geez, it's probably smart to just walk around it or try and like scare it off. But I usually just walk at it because they're never going to come at you. They will always go away. They're like if I compare them to deer in like the US or deer in general, you know, they're abundant and they're skittish and they're not going to just like run at you as a human.
Okay.
They'll run the other way. Yeah. No one has issues with kangaroos at all. But
so even
you know,
though
some
they're
of them
big
are,
and look scary.
Some of them are huge. Yeah. Some of them are huge and jacked. Like they have some muscle on them. They could knock you on your ass if they wanted to. But
I've definitely seen some pictures, very muscular kangaroos. And I'm like, I don't think I would want to antagonize that.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't go up trying to start a boxing match or anything, but they're like a deer. They're not gonna bother you.
They're just going to run off. Interesting.
But they're an awesome animal. Like they're my favorite animal. So just never gets old seeing them out in the bush.
Yeah. Yeah. I love seeing the wildlife when I'm out on my hikes. That's always my highlight. I really enjoy seeing wildlife. You know, even the snakes, as long as they're at a safe distance.
Yeah, of course.
Did you have any injuries or issues? When you're carrying a really heavy pack, it really increases your risk of injury. So did you have any issues out there?
I was in a lot of pain all the time, but I didn't get injured at all. Like I had no tendon issues, no muscle strains, nothing at the joints. I was really surprised how well my body held up. I think that first week, just because I was forced to sort of stick on the lower end of that 20-kilometer interval and I was doing, you know, that 35 miles a day, it was all pretty slow walking. I was taking regular breaks because I had the time. The body just adapted really well. And so the second half, I felt really strong. In saying that, like my feet were hurting really bad during the first week, like just throbbing and super painful. I was wearing Lone Peaks, Ultra Lone Peaks. And so like there's no support there. They're an incredible shoe. I love them. And once the pack got lighter, that was so good. But the first week my feet were hurting a lot, which I was like mildly worried about, but my feet have hurt before and I just like knew I just got to keep kind of pushing through. But other than that, yeah, like no injuries, nothing that really worried me throughout. And I was fully expecting my body to just like loosen up and then I'd figure out that everything was broken when I finished. But yeah, nothing was broken, which was really shocking. For me, like the biggest struggles weren't like injury. It was more like the sleep deprivation and just pushing those kind of mile limits. Like I'd never walked that kind of miles in a week before or multiple days in a row. And so it was just like kind of treading new ground in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I meant to ask you about that when we were talking about the camping. How much sleep were you getting per night?
Yeah. The first week, maybe the first 10 days, I reckon I averaged 5 hours a night, 4.5, 5 hours a night. And so I think I was getting like the first few days, I probably had like 6-7 hours. And I think that's another reason that my body adapted so well, was I was able to get some pretty good sleep at the start. But then the second week, once I pack lightened a bit, the trail got a little bit easier and I felt really, really strong still. I started just sacrificing heaps of sleep. And so maybe like 3 hours a night for the last week, maybe 3-4. And the last couple of days, barely slept at all, just kind of sent it and consumed a ridiculous amount of caffeine to sort of keep me cognizant. But I'd never sleep deprived before. Like I'd done like the 24-hour challenge on the PCT. I'd done like the odd, you know, 30-hour send, but I'd never sleep deprived myself for that length of time consistently. And so it was just like, it was really, really challenging, especially those last couple of days. I was hallucinating for the first time ever. I was taking wrong turns where usually I'd never do that. I just couldn't think straight. It was scary at times, honestly. I was just like, I've never felt like this before. This is crazy.
Yeah, that definitely seems like a common thing when you're sleep deprived for like maybe one day or 2 days, it doesn't really affect you. But yeah, when you get into that multiple days of sleep deprivation, you start having hallucinations or just muddled thinking. And yeah, it definitely can really start to affect you.
Yeah, yeah, it really did. And yeah, I knew I was going to get the record and beat my mate probably about after a week. I was like feeling good. I'm like, I got this, but I still really wanted to push myself to my limit. And so the last few days were just huge sends, and I had planned to not sleep for like 50 hours at the end if I could, but I had to take, I just had to, there was a couple of times where I was just like sat down on chair. I'm like, I am just so out of it and I have to sleep. And so I forced myself to have a nap like only 10 hours from the finish for a couple of hours, because I was just like completely gone. I would just see like flashes of light in my peripheral vision in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere. And it was just so like unnerving. I was like, that, it's not actually there. Like, how am I seeing these things?
Right. I actually had a similar experience my last night on my Arizona Trail FKT, and I kept seeing this like pink light. And then when I would turn toward it with my headlamp, then I couldn't see anything. And it happened over and over again. And then when I finished, I actually found out that we had a huge geomagnetic storm, and the Northern Lights or the Aurora Borealis was actually visible in Arizona. And my friend that picked me up, she had pictures, and then it was pink. And I couldn't see it because when I was turning my headlamp, then it was, you know, washing it out with my headlamp. So, but I was only seeing it out of my periphery. But it was that same thing where I was like, what is happening to me? I've never hallucinated weird lights or anything before. And I keep seeing pink lights. So
that's,
I don't know. Maybe you were having, you know, the aurora was happening. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe something was going on. It felt like, I just felt like a spotlight on the, like on the bush. It was weird. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, super crazy. Like your brain does all kinds of weird things, you know, when you haven't had enough sleep. So
yeah, I found that out. Yeah.
So I'd like to shift gears a little bit to the challenges of the trail itself. So when I was reading your report, it sounded like you went northbound to get the quote unquote harder sections out of the way first. And it sounded like there was a lot of beach walking, like you mentioned. But you also mentioned some flooded trails, some detours. Can you just talk about maybe some of the actual challenges of the route itself?
Yeah, so I think the hardest sections of the Bibb Track are the first couple of days on either end. And so it was interesting weighing up which way to go. So Marley, who had the previous FKT, he went southbound. I decided to go northbound. It just made a bit more sense to me, but the northern section is the hilliest, and so there's the most vertical change because it's sort of going through the Darling Scarp, which is like the hills near Perth. And then the southern section is also like relatively hilly, but it's more like sand dunes, so it's soft sand, and that's always really challenging as well. My logic was like, while my pack's heaviest, soft sand underfoot is going to be better for my feet and for my shoes to not deteriorate as much. So that's sort of one of the main reasons I started south, but also the south coast is very exposed to the elements. And so I thought if I could control when I started and pick a good weather window, that would also be a big benefit rather than just trying to like hope that the weather would be good at the end of the FKT. And I think I'm happy with that decision. It was really hard with the heavy pack on the soft sand though, really challenging. And on day two, I had a detour that I was forced to do that I didn't plan for. So there's quite a few like inlet crossings on the south coast, and there's this one Wilson Inlet that's particularly deep and it takes a lot longer for the sandbar to form, so you can walk across it. And I went down a couple of days before I started the FKT because it's about a 5-hour drive south of Perth where I live, and we checked out the inlet and it was just not safe to cross at all. And so the alternate, if you're unsupported, is unfortunately to walk around the entire inlet. If you're supported, you can just be driven around because that's sort of like an official route. But obviously, you know, you can't have vehicle support even if it's part of the official route in the unsupported category. So it was about a 10-mile walk that was extra that day that I sort of hadn't put into my itinerary, which really sucked. And it was all on road, like asphalt road. So I think that was probably the beginning of the foot pain because I was just like maximum weight on the pack. I did like a 65-kilometer day when I'd planned to do a 50, and the extra 15 was all on the road. So it was just like, I was pretty frustrated that day, actually just grinding away on the asphalt with massive trucks zooming past me. And there was one or two cars that stopped. And I'm like, you know, what the hell are you doing? Do you want to ride? We'll take you into town. Because there was like a town on the other side of the inlet. I'm like, no, I'm just out here doing my thing.
Right.
Yeah. So like, yeah, the most challenging sections of the trail are definitely the northernmost and the southernmost section. The middle is relatively flat in comparison and just really nice walkable trail for the most part. And so I was able to, you know, get some good miles in through that section, through like the middle sort of 300-400 kilometers. There were quite a few other detours that I had to take on the trail, which sucked as well, between like bushfires and prescribed burn offs and logging in certain areas. Like there was quite a few little reroutes I had to take. I ended up having to do something like 20 or 30 extra kilometers on top of the 1,000 kilometers of the official route, just due to pretty much just bad luck, which kind of sucked, because like that's like 6 to 8 hours. I could have gone faster if that didn't happen. And it's interesting looking back on the FKT, because I think with what I learned from it and optimizations I could make and picking a time where there isn't an extra 30 kilometers to do, I could cut quite a lot of time off of it. So I'm almost hoping someone comes and tries to beat it so I can have another crack.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, there is this one section called the Pingarup Plains, which was in the first week going northbound, which is notoriously flooded during spring and winter. And there was a lot of water on trail. For me, I had wet feet for about 48 hours because I'm just trudging, you know, up to like mid-thigh deep at times, which obviously slows you down as well. But then just having wet feet constantly sucked. And that was the one day that I came into camp was like the worst of the flooded trail. So I had wet feet all day. And then the second half of the day, it poured with rain. And it was just misery. It just sucked so bad. It was very nice to sort of finish that section after the first week, because like I left the sand behind me, I left the flooded trail behind me, and it was just like this next chapter of the FKT that gave me a real boost. Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely feel like there's this sense, and I'm sure you had this just through hiking in general, where you do something and you're just like, I'm so glad I don't ever have to do that again. It's behind me now. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, looking forward only.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there was plenty of moments like that on the FKT. I mean, I love the bib track so much and I'm sure I'll be out there again, but I was very happy to be done. Like when I reached the halfway mark over the trail, I was just like, I'm never thinking about that first half ever again. I'm just thinking about the finish now, and we're just trudging forward. And you kind of have to put the, like, you know, it's going to be hard, obviously, but you kind of have to put that out of mind and just look forward, you know, once you've gotten past it.
Right. Yeah. Did you have any moments where you thought about quitting?
I'm very stubborn, so I never seriously considered quitting. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of times where I was really running low on battery that I was a bit worried about how things would go. I took 30,000 milliamps worth of battery packs, and I was able to charge in some of the towns, because that's one of the kind of exceptions for unsupported FKTs is you can utilize public outlets in towns. But even with all that, I ran out of battery and I was really having to ration towards the end. And because I was live tracking and posting online, and I don't know, I was getting a bit stressed for a while there. But I never seriously thought about quitting, because I didn't have any sort of catastrophic injuries or anything that would basically force me off trail. I was very committed to getting it done. And I think part of the reason I wanted to post online as much as I could was just for that accountability. Like, you know, these people are watching. I've said I'm going to do something. And so, yep, I'm going to get it done. And that was quite a bit of big leg up as well. So I was very stubbornly going to get to the end kind of no matter what.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's nice to have that external, you know, I don't know, pressure, I guess, to totally. Like, okay, well, I don't want to fail now that I've, you know, put this out there. I want to let these people down. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting one. Like sometimes I don't want to tell the world that I'm doing something, because it's, once it's out there, it's like, of course you can just not do it still. It's fine. But you have this sort of underlying pressure. And for something like this, that's like very daunting. I was like, I want that. I want to put it out there. I want to commit to it and tell people that I'm going to get the FKT. And then like I have no choice but to kind of do it. And luckily it worked out for me this time. It could crash and burn as well, but yeah.
You mentioned choosing your weather window for the south, and then you also mentioned having some rain. So overall, what was the weather like? Did you feel like you had average weather, better than average weather? Did you get really unlucky with the weather? How did it go for you?
I would say I had a above average, like, good weather. I think overall it was about as good as I could possibly hope for during spring. I think I had 3 days of rain. Two of them were pretty crappy, to the point where, like, I was a little miserable. And then I had three or four really hot days as well. The last day was the hottest day of the trail, and that was so tough. But, you know, when you're within reach of the finish, it was just kind of like, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to get there. But other than those, like, kind of really hot days and a couple of rainy days, it was really just mild, sort of low 20s Celsius, a lot of the time clouded with no rain, just perfect hiking conditions. And there were quite a few days where I just, like, yeah, like, I never felt like I needed to drink extra water. I never felt like I needed to hide away from the rain or the sun. And I could just walk all day extremely comfortably at a good pace. And I think I got lucky, because, like, there tends to be, probably on average, you'd probably experience a bit more rain in the south, and you'd probably experience a bit more heat in the north. But yeah, almost every day was pretty pristine for me.
And that does sound like pretty much perfect hiking conditions for the most part.
If it's really hot, it's just, you just can't output as much. And if it's really wet, then it's just miserable. And so I remember thinking during it, I'm like, this is really nice. This is really lucky, having these back-to-back-to-back days of just perfect conditions. And luckily, for the most part, it lasted throughout the whole FKT.
Yeah. I feel like that's a kind of a rarity in through hiking. I feel like most of the time, you know, you don't get a whole series of perfect weather days. There's always at least one or two in there that are just either too hot or too cold or too wet or too sunny, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was pretty lucky, I think. And I remember talking to my mate Marley, who set the FKT initially, and he had some pretty shocking weather, like quite a bit more rain than I did. And it definitely makes a difference. Like, you know, picking weather windows and then just straight up getting lucky can be the difference of hours or potentially days on these really long trails. So yeah, I'm pretty stoked with how it turned out.
Anything else you'd like to share about the route or the FKT or this experience in general that we haven't talked about?
I loved it. I really loved the experience. I wasn't sure how I would feel coming at the other end. And I was so happy to be done, and seeing my wife and family and friends at the finish line and getting to eat real food again was the best feeling of my life. It was so good.
Yeah.
But even just a couple of weeks after the trail, I was like, I actually miss it. Like, I miss being out there suffering, which I don't know if I expected to feel like that. I wasn't planning to do other FKTs, or, like, I had no plans past just doing my local one that I kind of wanted to do for a long time. But now I'm like, I do want to experience that again. And so that's been an interesting sort of evolution that's come from it, where, like, it was miserable the whole time. I was starving, I was in pain, it hurt, but in hindsight, it was just like the best thing ever. Like, I really loved it. And I'm sure you felt that as well. I mean, you have like 1,000 FKTs, so you clearly enjoy the suffering and keep coming back time and time again. But yeah, I think I have another crack at something else at some point. So yeah, loved it.
And that type 2 fun that causes short-term memory loss, because you just kind of forget, mm-hmm. and you're just like, that was great, I'm going to do that again.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. I think it helps that not a whole lot went wrong for me, like no injuries, no, right. You know, traumatizing weather, no snake bites or anything like that. So whilst it was pure suffering for 14 days, it's a bit easier to sort of reflect and have that type 2 fun sort of realization pretty quickly.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and chatting with us. I really appreciate it. It's great hearing all about this.
Yeah, my pleasure, Heather. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks again, Cam, for coming on the show. You can read about his FKT on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and follow his adventures on Instagram at Cam Bostock.